In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. Whatever the virtues of the many fields of knowledge, all our steps on the path of omniscience, may these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. O Manjushri, please accomplish this. Good evening and welcome. So tonight we shift to a commentary by Rongzheng Dorje, the third Karmapa, on the same root text by Maitreya, Dharma Dharmatava Bhanga, on just the section on enlightenment, fundamental transformation. So it's about 45 pages, and I split it up into about 15 pages per class. So I circulated the whole root commentary, that is. But let's start on page 251 of Sane.
Can I ask one question on the syllabus? That it's paid the third page, the last page of the syllabus is what we're doing now, right?
Yeah.
So there's just one other thing that's a little odd. The on the headers of the next two classes, this one, it shows numbers that don't jive with the numbers on each line, and I just wondered if those are from like a different pagination.
They are. I didn't update those. Thank you. I have
okay,
to
so we should
update
just
those.
Ignore the ones on the header line and follow the ones on the detail lines, I think.
That's right. Thank you. I'll have
great
to fix that.
Yep.
The
no issue. Just wanted to make sure that there wasn't some other section that we had to go back to.
Yeah. That was from before I had the commentary by Vasubandhu programmed in there.
Okay, thanks. That's all.
Yeah, thank you for pointing that out. It says class 10, 250 to 296. That's not right.
Well, that one would be what, 251 to 262 or something like that, or 263.
That's right.
And then the next two are the ones that I really noticed were wrong because they were back into the 100s.
Indeed. Okay, so on page 251, the completely perfect fundamental change in terms of these points that are taught below teaches the unsurpassable fundamental change of Buddhahood. So what are these points? Brief introduction. Through comprehending the nature, so these are the points, the entity, the persons, the 10 points, the distinctive features, the prerequisites, the foundation, the mental engagement, the trainings, the shortcomings, and the benefits. Those are the 10 topics for fundamental transformation or change. The fundamental change, so the bold indented is the root text by Maitreya, and then there's the commentary by Rongzheng Dorje along with lots of quotes. The fundamental change is to be understood through these following 10 points, teaching what the nature of the fundamental change is, which entities undergo the fundamental change, which persons undergo the fundamental change, the distinctive features of the fundamental changes of Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas versus the one of the Mahayana, on which prerequisites it, i.e. the fundamental change, depends, based on which foundation of the fundamental change this change takes place, the mental engagement that is the cause of the fundamental gain, change rather. 8, how to train in the path that leads to it. 9, the existence of 4 shortcomings if there is no fundamental change, and 10, the benefits of its existence, starting with so then the detailed explanation has these 10 parts. Explanation of the nature of the fundamental change. As for comprehending the nature, it is stainless suchness in terms of adventitious stains and suchness not appearing and appearing respectively. Adventitious stains are one's own stainless and naturally luminous mind as such, but by virtue of this very mind being ignorant of itself, cognizance appears in a dualistic way as if it were a separate apprehender and apprehended. Mind bifurcates itself into subject and object. Mirage-like mental conceptions arise, and these false imaginations obscure luminous suchness. If these obscurations do not appear, suchness will appear, just as in the example of water appearing to be clear and transparent once it has become pure of silt. This is the nature of the fundamental change. The Mahayana Sutra Alamkara by Maitreya says, when murky water becomes clear, its transparency does not arise from elsewhere, but is just its becoming free from pollution. The same goes for the purity of your own mind. It is held that mind, which is always naturally luminous, is only blemished by adventitious flaws. Apart from the mind that is the nature of phenomena, no other mind is proclaimed to be luminous in nature. Luminosity and natural emptiness are not tainted by the nature of conceptions, since conceptions are nothing but non-existents that appear. So what is non-existent appears, and what is existent does not appear. This is stated many times, such as in the Dharma Dhatustava, which I believe is the praise to Dharmata, or Dharma Dhatu, rather, by Nagarjuna. About water at the time of spring, what we say is that it's warm. Of the very same thing, when it's chilly, we say that it is cold. Covered by the web of the afflictions, it is called a sentient being. Once it's freed from the afflictions, it should be expressed as Buddha. Also, the Hevajra Tantra says sentient beings are Buddhas indeed, however, they are obscured by adventitious stains. If these are removed, they are Buddhas. This is the nature of the fundamental change. Since it is understood in this way, it is explained that it is comprehended. 2. Which entities undergo the fundamental change? The connecting passage is the comprehension of the entity. There are three such entities. What are they? This refers to the change of the suchness of the cognizance that is the common container, the change of the suchness of the Dharma Dhatu of the Sutra collection, and the change of the suchness of the cognizance that is the Dhatu of sentient beings, which is not in common. A little bit cryptic, Maitreya. So, Rongjung Dorje. Thus, as for the cognizance that is the container, at the time of being impure, it appears as the world that it appears as the world that is an impure realm. But when it has become pure, it therefore changes into a pure Buddha realm. This refers to the factors that consist of the five sense objects and the five sense faculties. Maitreya says in his Abhisamaya Alamkara, the world of sentient beings is impure, and so is the world that is the environment. By virtue of accomplishing the purity of those, the purity of a Buddha realm appears. So it's the same basis, but two different ways of appearing based on whether the adventitious stains are present or removed. The Mahayana Sutra Alamkara says, in the fundamental change of perception and its reference, supreme mastery is attained over pure realms in order to display enjoyments just as one pleases. So that's one of the three, which is the container. And we're talking about which entities undergo fundamental change. So the container, i.e., the environment, the display changes. Two, the Dharma Dhatu, the sutra collection, refers to the purity of the clinging to the characteristics of the pitakas, which are baskets, collections of the Dharma that make up the teaching. Excuse me, such as words, phrases, and letters, as well as the mastery over them. This is the fundamental change of the sixth consciousness, mentation, including conceptions. The Mahayana Sutra Alamkara says, in the Mahayana Sutra Alamkara, we find in the fundamental change of conception, supreme mastery is attained over wisdom and activities unimpeded at all. At all times. So the second thing that changes is the sixth consciousness and the way it understands the Dharma, I guess. It's a little interesting.
The first one, it seemed to be clear that it's changing from the environment to Buddha realms.
Yeah.
But this one doesn't really say that what the two is, right?
No, it doesn't have like a from and to.
Huh.
The Dharma Dhatu, the sutra collection, refers to the purity of the clinging to the characteristics. Okay. Three, the Dhatu of sentient beings, which is not in common, is the Alaya consciousness. It is called not in common because it is the result that is produced by the karmic formations, the seven consciousnesses of each individual mind stream. Its fundamental change has two elements. The Dharmakaya is what manifested the element of the foundation, the Alaya, having become pure. Equality is what manifests through the fundamental change of the element, that is the active agent, the afflicted mind. The Mahayana Sutra Alamkara says, in the fundamental change of mentation, supreme mastery is attained over utterly stainless, non-conceptual wisdom ensuing from mastery. And in the fundamental change of the foundation, supreme mastery is attained over the non-abiding nirvana in the stateless story. In the stainless state of the Buddhas. In brief, these entities that undergo the fundamental change are referred to as three because they're three different results in terms of appearance, the outer environment, instruction, the teachings, and the beholder or the beholding. So the interesting part about that was the third one is that the afflicted mind, the seventh consciousness, turns into the Dharmakaya. Did I get that right?
No, the Alaya turns into the Dharmakaya, and the
Right,
afflicted mind
sorry.
turns into equality.
That's right, the wisdom of equality. Pride is transformed into wisdom of equality, the pride of the afflicted mind. Yeah, so the Alaya turns into Dharmakaya. That makes sense. And then the seventh becomes one of the five wisdoms of the Sambhogakaya level. The persons who undergo the fundamental change, part number three, has two parts, the fundamental changes that are not in common among sentient beings and the fundamental change that is in common. So, hi, Lindsay. We're on page 254 of the handout that I circulated. Text page 254. The fundamental changes that are not in common, as for comprehending the persons who undergo this change, the first two are the fundamental changes of suchness of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So those are not in common. Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas do not need the first two kinds of fundamental change explained above because they strive for personal peace without purifying the container. And all phenomena in general. However, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas need them because they display kayas, wisdoms, and enlightened activities by virtue of their mastery over all realms and phenomena. Therefore, these two fundamental changes are called not in common with Sravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas. That makes sense. They don't have a Dharmakaya transformation into Dharmakaya of the Alaya, and they don't have a transformation into Sambhogakaya of the seventh consciousness and the others. The fundamental change that is in common, the latter one refers also to those of Sravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas. What is taught above by the Dhatu of sentient beings, which is not in common, is the factor of the Alaya consciousness, which functions as the foundation of all afflictions in the three realms. This must be relinquished by all noble ones because the afflictive obscurations, including their foundation, are the common factors to be overcome. Since all noble ones are equal in being liberated from these factors to be relinquished, such relinquishment is also taught as the Vimukti-kaya. Vimukti is liberation in Sanskrit, so it's the liberation body. The following lines in the Samdhi-nirmocana Sutra unraveling the intent also teach just this. This uncontaminated Dhatu of those who are liberated is not anything that can be designated as two or one. Not quite sure what that quote means. Four, instruction on the distinctive features of the fundamental change has two parts. The first is the distinctive feature in terms of realms. The comprehension, the root text says, the comprehension of the distinctive features is by virtue of the distinctive feature of the purity of the realms of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. After the factors that consist of the consciousnesses, the characteristics that exist in the Alaya and appear as objects have been purified. All Buddhas and Bodhisattvas possess the purity of their realms, and their display is also unimpeded. This is because they have gained mastery over the profound dependent origination with regard to apprehending specifically characterized phenomena without there being a creator of realms. So this is an explanation of Buddha fields, Buddha realms, that had come about through the transformation of the Alaya, the complete transformation of the Alaya to the Dharmakaya, as we saw earlier. In this part, this is because they've gained mastery over the profound dependent origination. So there's places where dependent origination is said to be to go in two directions. Dependent origination of the 12 links that result in the full-blown creation of samsara, and then when we work those backwards, it results in the full-blown realization of nirvana when we reverse the 12 nidanas and uproot the ignorance that is the first of them, then the enlightenment occurs. And I believe that's here what is referred to as the profound dependent origination.
Am I being simplistic in interpreting that when it says apprehending specifically characterized phenomena without there being a creator of realms, is that basically saying, being able to experience without an experiencer?
I think so.
Like it's a way of saying non-dual experience, sort of. Anyway.
Without there being a creator of realms, the creator of the realms is the Alaya, right? Or the Alaya Vijnana.
Right, I think so. So by having purified the Alaya, there's nothing, and presumably the afflicted consciousness as well, that which grabs it all as me, then by having purified all that, then it's basically somehow experience without ownership or without
It
dual.
comes about without ownership. Yeah, I think it could also refer to the Buddha realms that appear sort of spontaneously without there being a creator.
Right. I mean, I think it's, in some ways, I think it's both of those. Because
Right.
if you get to the experience of this full non-duality, hopefully you actually would be in some kind of
Right, the
eternal
Buddha
realm.
realms. Yeah. Interesting statement, that sentence.
Yeah.
Since the Shravakas do not purify the aspect of the container, in this way it appears to them in common with other sentient beings. The container of the Pratyeka Buddhas is purified a little bit, but since they leave it behind and enter the uncontaminated Dhatu of Nirvana, their purification of the container is pointless. That was interesting. Let's see. Secondly, in terms of the distinctive features of the fundamental change, the second part is the distinctive features in terms of the attainment. And by virtue of the distinctive feature of having attained seeing, instruction, and mastery through the attainment of the Dharmakaya, Sambhogikukaya, and then Nyayamanikakaya, respectively. Dharmakaya is the mastery overseeing the entirety of the suchness and variety of noble objects. So those are the two aspects of omniscience, seeing the suchness of phenomena and the variety of phenomena, known as noble objects. The Sambhogikakaya refers to the instruction in and the mastery over the profound and vast Dharma. It teaches many amazing doors of such Dharma, Dharma doors, innumerable Dharma doors. This interesting phrase that is often used in the Hiena Sutras. The Nyayamanikakaya is the attainment and display of inconceivable qualities that are the foundation for accomplishing all kinds of beneficial activities for sentient beings. Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas don't even know about these. They do not have these kayas. The fifth topic is the explanation of comprehending the distinctive features of the prerequisites. The root text says the comprehension of the prerequisites is by virtue of the distinctive features of previous aspiration prayers, by virtue of the distinctive feature of the focal object that is the Mahayana teaching, and by virtue of the distinctive feature of training on the 10 bhumis. Rongchen Dorje says the comprehension of the prerequisites, the causes for attaining the fruition of the three kayas, is through three points. Previous aspiration prayers start on the level of engagement through aspiration, which is like beginner level, where I am, and maybe you guys are. Continue through accomplishing the 10 great aspiration prayers, and this refers to this famous text, the Aspiration of the Bodhisattva Samantabhadra. That is one of the most important texts in the Nyingma, well, in the Tibetan Mahayana tradition. There's actually two different texts that have the same name. The Nyingmapas have another text of the same name. That's a Dzogchen Tantra. But let's see. Sorry, I didn't look up the footnotes. See. Wow, Carl's footnotes are so extensive. Let's see. He says Bodhisattvas on the first bhumi make 10 great aspirations. So that's what these 10 are. So on the level of engagement through aspiration, so that's not a beginner like me, it's a first bhumi Bodhisattva. And the 10 aspirations are to provide for the worship of all Buddhas without exception, to maintain the religious discipline that has been taught by all the Buddhas, and to preserve the teaching of the Buddhas is number 2. Three is to see all the incidents in the earthly career of a Buddha. Four is to realize bodhicitta, to practice all the duties of bodhisattvas, to acquire all the paramitas and purify all the stages of their career. Five, to mature all beings and establish them in the knowledge of a Buddha. Six, to perceive the whole universe. Seven, to purify and cleanse all the Buddha realms. Eight, to enter the Mahayana and to produce a common intention and purpose in all bodhisattvas. Nine, to make all actions of body, speech, and mind fruitful and successful. And ten, to attain supreme and perfect enlightenment and to teach the Dharma.
So those 10 occur on the first bhumi, is that right?
That's right.
So how does that work? It's like, is there some place where when people, go through that process of transformation and get to that path, that bhumi, that somebody walks up and says, here's the 10 aspirations you should be now working on? I mean, it's like, how do people arrive at this? Do you have any idea?
No.
Oh,
No, I don't. But I guess it's sort of like at that point you become a real bodhisattva, and real bodhisattvas have are expected to undertake these aspirations in
is it
general,
just
I
like a
think.
natural inclination that they would do it somehow spontaneously?
That's right.
Okay, got it. This
I think so.
It's not like there's a liturgy for this.
Yeah.
Curious. And
All
so
right, I was
all of
looking at
that
the
was, all
notes.
of what you just read is just that list of 10,
That's right.
which is just part of the three or the part of the aspiration package.
That's right.
And then there's more at the eighth bhumi, et
Three
cetera.
points, yeah. So that's they start on the level of engagement through aspiration. They continue through accomplishing the great as 10 great aspiration prayers on the bhumis of pure superior intention. Oh, wait a second. 6:54 and 5. So on the first bhumi, you make the 10 great aspirations in 6:55, pure note, footnote. In general, superior intention is the term for the superior altruistic attitude of bodhisattvas, which means that they have solely the welfare of others in mind. They do so with the same spontaneous intensity with which ordinary beings usually strive for their own well-being. This attitude is said to be the immediate prerequisite or cause for the arising of uncontrived, genuine bodhicitta, even in ordinary beings. This attitude, the superior intention. Here, however, pure superior intention indicates the generation of bodhicitta on the first seven bodhisattva bhumis, and then culminate in the perfect accomplishment of aspiration prayers on the eighth bhumi, which is where the paramita of aspiration is perfected, or the practice of aspiration is brought to the level of a paramita, perfection, transcendently perfected. That is engaging as in the immeasurable exemplary life story of the Bodhisattva Samantabhadra. This is the prerequisite of pure speech, i.e. Sambhogakaya. Two, as for the distinctive features of the focal object, bodhisattvas focus on prajnaparamita, in which the entirety of the Mahayana is combined into one in a non-conceptual manner. Through focusing on all Mahayana dharmas individually without combining them. So that's a great feat. And you see reference to this idea in a number of places. Like it's in the Samdhi-Nirmocana Sutra, the chapter on meditation, where bodhisattvas are able to comprehend all the dharmas simultaneously without. But here, I don't know that I've ever seen this nuance of in which the entirety of the Mahayana is combined into one in a non-conceptual manner through focusing on all Mahayana dharmas individually without combining them. I've never seen that nuance of not combining them, but I've seen this reference to bodhisattvas comprehending all dharmas simultaneously.
It seems like it's saying the two opposite things, though, in which the
The
entirety is
first one, yeah.
combined, and then the second one is talking about it not combined. So is it that they do both, each of those, in
I
different?
think so.
Yeah.
I think the first one is the wisdom of knowing the suchness of phenomena, and the second is the wisdom of knowing the extent or the variety of phenomena, or the way they manifest. Without combining them, they engage in their being illusion-like. Through focusing on the suchness of all these dharmas, the power for teaching the Mahayana dharmas arises because they engage in it through limitless dharanis and discriminating awarenesses. The distinctive feature of training on the 10 bhumis is due to relinquishing the two obscurations, including their latent tendencies, and attaining supreme wisdom, and thereby making the activity of accomplishing the qualities of the 10 paramitas unimpeded for as long as samsara lasts. How long is samsara supposed said to be lasting? In
Endless.
this. It's endless, right? In this way, the prerequisites for wisdom and enlightened activity becoming pure by virtue of aspiration, prayers, focal objects, and training are taught. This point is also explained in the chapter on the generation of bodhicitta in the Mahayana Sutra Alankara. Because of accomplishing the 10 great aspiration prayers, it should be understood as magnanimous. Because of not becoming weary by hardships over a long time, it should be realized to be enthusiasm. Because of realizing the closeness to enlightenment and acquiring the means and prajna for that, it should be understood as pure intention, while skill and means comes on another level. Through mentally engaging in how things are, through realizing the conceptuality of that, and through not conceptualizing this realization, it should be understood as final deliverance. Deliverance, what a funny term for liberation. Thus, the above accords with what the Mahayana Sutra Alankara says about Buddhahood being accomplished through training in magnanimity, enthusiasm, pure intention, and final deliverance. For Shravakas and Pratyekabuddhas, these trainings are pointless because they aspire to exit samsara all by themselves, seize the Dharma only temporarily like a raft, and possess the limited trainings that make them go beyond the three realms through their own respective levels. In this way, these 5 points of nature, entity, persons, distinctions, and prerequisites, which have the nature of being what is founded on the foundation that is non-conceptual wisdom, are taught based on the factors to be relinquished and their remedies. Seems that's
Excuse
a, yeah.
me. Go ahead and finish what you were going to say.
That's an interesting way of summing up the 5 first points. Of these 10. It's a little bit odd, which have the nature of being what is founded on the foundation that is non-conceptual wisdom. How is it that nature, entity, and persons are founded on that? Anyway, Cynthia.
Actually, I just because we keep the, we are constantly contrasting this with the Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas who are going for nirvana. I realized I wanted to understand in the vast scheme of things what in this context is nirvana viewed to be. I mean, I understand that it's not the ultimate liberation, but like where does it fit? Does it actually exist as a sort of realm of some kind? Do you know what I mean? It's like if they're getting out of samsara, but they're not getting fully liberated, then they're in You know, I mean, I know they talk about, you know, they have to, they sort of hang out in some kind of holding pattern until somebody comes along and taps them and says, okay, you got to become a bodhisattva. But aside from that little fairy tale or true tale, whatever it may be, what exactly is the understanding of where they are and how one abides in that nirvana? Do you have any idea?
Well, they're not in any place. They're in the in sort of a cessation trance, if that means anything.
Okay, and so that's it. The idea is that they're it's b without body
And without mind.
and without mind. Can you be without mind? Or is it just mind in a state of
I guess they're in their Alivijnana. They're not, they still have their eighth consciousness, which
right, they
creates the
have to be something.
continuity.
Right.
Yeah, that creates the continuity. So then they're woken up later by the Buddhas and then invited and they're brought into the Mahayana path.
So it's
But,
basically a non-corporeal
oh yeah.
of Alivijnana, sort of. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry,
And
what?
in the scheme of the absorption states, there's the four absorptions, 1, 2, 3, and 4, aptly named. And then those are the form level, form realm absorptions. And then there's the formless realm absorptions of space or consciousness space. I can't remember which comes first. Consciousness space. Neither perception nor non-perception and nothing whatsoever, something like that. And then beyond that is cessation trance, Nirodha, which is this odd thing that it's like they say this is where enlightened ones, i.e. arhats, can spend time while they're alive and relish the enjoyment of nirvana until they and they're talking about Travakas and Pratyekabuddhas until they let go of their physical body, at which point they achieve full nirvana. So they have this idea that there's nirvana with residue during one's lifetime and nirvana without residue after one's lifetime. But that Nirodha, which is cessation trance, is a way of experiencing the bliss of complete release while one's still alive.
So that would be the nirvana with residue. Is that nirvana?
Yes, that's the
Okay.
nirvana with still residue.
Okay, so
And
then when they pass from their bodies, then they're in the nirvana without residue, which I've heard of that too. So I guess that's the one that I was asking about. So basically that's kind of somehow abiding in the Alivijnana and without, I mean, is there clarity in that or is it, anyway, you know.
yeah, I don't think so. I don't think there's any clarity. I think their mind is sort of suspended. It's like being just in suspension.
So this is actually what I mean from, I guess, other points of view, like Dzogchen or whatever. This is a place you don't want to go.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
It's different. It's different than the flaws that are listed. But when they go through the errors in the ways of understanding the accomplishment of various practices, they're talking about a lower level of experience. So they're talking about cessation trance because they're talking about people that are alive.
Can you back up just a little bit? Because you guys are going so fast. Nirvana with residue versus without. Now, what is that from again?
Either there's a body or there's no body, is what
But
that means.
So in the early tradition of Buddhism, the first few centuries, the Buddhism that was popularly known in the first few centuries, what we call Hinayana Buddhism,
Right.
or what sometimes is now called Theravadan Buddhism, they have this notion that there's two types of nirvana. that there's a nirvana that a fully enlightened one will experience when they're still alive, when they still have the continuity of the physical body and the karma that comes along with that. And that's called with residue, nirvana with residue. They have a body, they have to eat, they have to sleep, they, do things that a body does. And then after they pass away, they enter into great nirvana without residue. And so the Mahayana tradition was tasked, so to speak, with the project of somehow coming up with a nirvana that surpasses those. So they said, well, that nirvana without residue is a temporary, is a lesser type of nirvana. It's a dualistic nirvana that is a state that's brought about by the path, and it's the antithesis of samsara. And that the nirvana of a bodhisattva or a Buddha surpasses that because it's not localized. So they call it non-abiding nirvana. Nirvana that doesn't matter whether you have a body or not, because the body is not an impediment to nirvana. It's incidental. So that's the Mahayana version of nirvana, is non-abiding nirvana. And it's the same before death as after passing away out of the physical body. Because the physical body for the Mahayana high-level bodhisattva, the 10th Bhumi, is just a manifestation, one of thousands supposedly manifestation bodies that a 10th-level bodhisattva has. And what's interesting here is that there's in the development of Mahayana, there's this period where they have this notion that beings have a certain sort of predetermined possible path. Some people are cut out for the Shravaka path, some people are cut out for the Pratyekabuddha path, and some few more exceptional ones are cut out for the Bodhisattva path. And then they have these two other groups of people, one of which is indeterminate. It's like could go either way. And then there's what's called the cutoff family, which is like they're not going anywhere.
Just the Gotra thing?
That's the five gotras, the five families, so to speak. And so the early Mahayana has this notion. There's a number of sutras that present this scheme, and they present it as like these are final situations. And they don't have this idea that Shravakas and Pratyekabuddhas are going to be awakened by the Buddhas and then enter the Bodhisattva path. It's like they're gone. But later Mahayana says, no, that's not right. Everybody's going to become a Buddha. And some people just need to have that lesser type of nirvana for a while, because that's what their nature is. And the cutoff family and the indeterminate, they also are ultimately going to enter into the Bodhisattva family and become Buddhas. And so that's what's presented in the sutra called the Lotus Sutra. You may have heard of it. It's a very famous sutra where the Buddha gives this analogy of samsara as a burning house, of a mansion of a very rich person who, it's like Elon Musk has a huge mansion, and he has all of his family, like there's like 25, 50 people living in this mansion together, lots of little kids. And he comes home from work one day and he sees that the mansion is on fire. And he can see that because he's outside the mansion, and he has he's on a hill as he approaches the house, and he can see the top of the house. There's smoke coming out. He says, oh shit, this house is a goner. How am I going to get these people out of the house as fast as possible? And if I tell them that this house is not the best house, that there's actually better houses, they're going to argue with me. They're going to say, well, this house is not that bad and we can repair it, we can put out the fire. And they're going to hem and haw, and before you know it, they're going to get killed by the fire because the fire is just going to engulf them. So I got to come up with a way of getting them out of the house as fast as possible. So he comes home and he gives them all like gifts, like fancy cars to the adults, and then really cool toys and computers to the children out in the front lawn. And they all like come out very quickly to enjoy these gifts. And then lo and behold, the whole house burns down, but nobody gets hurt. And that's the idea that the Buddha entices sentient beings out of samsara based on their proclivity with various levels of attainment that are geared towards their capability, because that's the fastest way to get them their butts moving. And if the Buddha had said to them, "You're all going to be Buddhas," they wouldn't have believed him. They would have dilly-dallied and they would have like hemmed and hawed. But instead, for many people, he dwells endlessly on the horrors of samsara as a way of getting the Shravakas and Pratyekabuddhas to move. Anyway,
And
so that's.
thus is born the, what do we call, provisional teachings?
Yes, exactly. So the idea is that the Buddha gives these provisional teachings to beings on a, in a temporary way, and that ultimately all these beings will be led into the Bodhisattva path. They may spend a few kalpas in nirvana, and then they'll be awakened from their trance, and then come into the Bodhisattva path. And so that was a great revelation of the Lotus Sutra. And the Lotus Sutra is the sort of main sutra for Pure Land Buddhism that morphs later into Pure Land Buddhism, which became very popular in the East, but it was also common in Tibet, and we don't really hear about it. It's sort of interesting. But anyway, that was a rather long sidebar on this way that this text is talking about Shravakas and Pratyekabuddhas, as if the way this text is talking about them is if those are like final paths. We don't see like this temporary quality of their achievement. They exit samsara, seize the Dharma temporarily like a rat, possess the limited trainings that make them go beyond the three realms through their own respective levels. Anyway, point six, instruction on the foundation of all this, based on which the fundamental change takes place. So, what is the foundation for which the change takes place? And this has a brief introduction and then a detailed explanation, which has many parts to it. The connecting passage from the root text, the comprehension of the foundation, refers to comprehending non-conceptual wisdom through six points. So now we focus exclusively on non-conceptual wisdom as the main cause for enlightenment, or the main factor or foundation. The brief introduction to these six, this comprehension in six points, is by virtue of the focal objects, the relinquishment of characteristics, two, the correct yogic practice, three, four, the defining characteristics, five, the benefit, and six, the thorough knowledge. When comprehending the non-conceptual wisdom of the Buddha Bhagavan, such comprehension is by virtue of examining the same list, the focal objects through which one engages in this wisdom, which conceptions about characteristics are relinquished. Which is funny wording, it like implies some conceptions are not relinquished. How one practices this wisdom, of which kind its defining characteristics are, what its benefit is, and six, that non-conceptual wisdom is known through the knowledge of certain points. Now we have a detailed explanation of these six parts. First, the fourfold comprehension of the focal objects. The introduction from the root text is the comprehension of the focal objects through four points. What are those four? It is by virtue of the Mahayana teaching, one, aspiring for it, two, being certain about it, three, and the completion of the accumulations, four. Which is interesting because there's three of them that are like preparatory. Seeing the virtue in the Mahayana, aspiring for it, and developing certainty in it, and then actually engaging in it. In the Uttara Tantra by Maitreya, this wisdom, non-conceptual wisdom, is taught through the term basic element, gotra. Here it is discussed, or maybe garbha. I wonder. Here it is discussed under the term non-conceptual wisdom. In the Prajnaparamita text, it is treated under the name Prajnaparamita. In the Mahayana Sangraha, which is a wonderful text by Sangha, we find there is no difference between Prajnaparamita and non-conceptual wisdom. Later in the tradition, we have this notion that like non-conceptual wisdom and like primordial wisdom is higher than transcendent knowledge, than Prajnaparamita. So like the 10th Bhumi Paramita is higher than the 6th. But here we have the statement that within the scheme of the Prajnaparamita texts, Prajnaparamita is equivalent to the 10th level primordial wisdom. Therefore, the Uttara Tantra says, as for what is to be awakened, awakening, its branches, and what causes awakening in due order, one point is the cause, and three are the conditions for its purity. The Ratnagotra-vibhaga-vyakhya. Now, the Ratnagotra-vibhaga-vyakhya is one of a variety of commentaries. There's a number of different types of commentaries. We often see the word vritti as one commentary. I think vritti is more of like a word commentary, and vyakhya is like a general commentary, but I'm not sure. But Ratnagotra-vibhaga is an alternate name for the Uttara Tantra. And this text that is the commentary on it uses the name Ratnagotra-vibhaga instead of Uttara Tantra. And it seems that the commentary, this Ratnagotra-vibhaga-vyakhya, is by a Sangha. And but it's a little bit unclear who the author of it is. And this has led many Western scholars to come to a funny conclusion that Maitreya and Asanga were one and the same person. That the 10th stage Bodhisattva Maitreya could not have written any texts because that's a fictitious creature. And that really Asanga wrote all these texts. And they cite the lack, the colophon to this text as support for that. Anyway. In that commentary, it says that since all noble objects are included in these four topics, the first one is the point of what is to be realized. The second is the realization of it, i.e., enlightenment. The branches are the Buddha qualities. Since these qualities function as the conditions for realization, they also represent the enlightened activity. As for the explanation of the basic element and the three jewels, the basic element is to be understood as the cause and the three jewels as the conditions. So here the basic element is the garbha, the Tathagata garbha. From both this cause and these conditions, so Buddha nature, Tathagata garbha, and the three jewels, Buddha Dharma and Sangha as conditions, the result, enlightenment, its qualities and the enlightened activity arises. Now, these are the seven chapters of the Uttara Tantra. The Uttara Tantra has these seven chapters that are these seven topics that were just named. And the fourth chapter on the Buddha element, Garbha, Tathagata garbha, is the most famous and the largest of the chapters. Therefore, the basic element, which bears the conventional term cause, is the nature of non-conceptual wisdom. when the 32-fold enlightened activity of a Buddha. So a Buddha has 32 major and 64 minor marks of a super being, but I wouldn't call them activities. The note says this refers to the functions of the 32 qualities of the Dharmakaya, which are the 10 powers, the 4 fearlessnesses, and the 18 unique qualities of a Buddha. So those are the core qualities of a Buddha, and those apply to the Dharmakaya, those 32 major. Let's see. So when the 32-fold enlightened activity of a Buddha, the condition, i.e. for the realization of other beings, operates the three jewels, which are based on this enlightened activity being labeled as Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha through the terms of these other beings, arise. The English of that sentence sort of eludes me at the moment. When the 32-fold enlightened activity of a Buddha, let's skip the parentheticals, operates, the three jewels arise. Okay. I like the way it has brackets within parentheticals. I guess the parenthetical is by the author, and the brackets are by the translator. It is therefore that Maitreya speaks here of the Mahayana Dharma. Thus, a Buddha's teaching of the Dharma refers to those to be guided, attaining those conditions of enlightened activity manifesting to them in the form of the three jewels, which appear as if being external. Based on that, aspiration for the three jewels arises in them. If they aspire for these jewels, they engage in them through being certain about them, which leads to the arising of vigor. Vigor. If that is present, through engaging and gathering the two accumulations, they will complete those accumulations. However, if one of these four factors is lacking, non-conceptual wisdom does not arise in the form of the result. This is why these four focal objects are taught. Consequently, the Uttara Tantra says the following about them, including their progression. They make the confident resolve. This inconceivable object exists. It can be attained by someone like me, and its attainment possesses such qualities. This inconceivable object, Buddha nature, or Buddhahood. Thereby bodhicitta, the receptacle of qualities such as confidence, vigor, mindfulness, dhyana, which is meditation or samadhi, and prajna, is present in them at all times. The most interesting thing here is that, for me, is that the Uttara Tantra is famous for talking about Buddha nature. And for it to also talk about bodhicitta is very cool, because this is often a confusing topic for people. Like, what's the relationship between Buddha nature and bodhicitta? And bodhicitta is here glossed basically as the receptacle of qualities such as confidence, vigor, mindfulness, dhyana, and prajna, which is present in them at all times. Since that mind, that confidently resolved mind, is always present, is that what that refers to? That mind, maybe that bodhicitta mind, is always present. The children of the victors, i.e. bodhisattvas, are irreversible and reach the completion and purity of the paramita of merit. Yes?
I'm just curious about the notion of bodhicitta as a receptacle of qualities. I just wonder if you have any thoughts, or is that just something we have to contemplate more?
Yeah, it's a very interesting thing. Well, There's clearly this relationship where Buddha nature is like an entity and bodhicitta is a quality that's cultivated, right? Except
Well,
for
I mean, Buddha
ultimate
nature is sort of
bodhicitta.
the end game, and bodhicitta is that, I mean, it's generally defined as the aspiration and engagement of getting to that end point, right?
Right. The aspiration to and the engagement in getting to that end point. But the Buddha nature is the beginning and the end, the ground and the fruition.
Right. And so I guess it's just, I mean, I guess somehow it's obviously sort of a path quality thing of, you know, since bodhicitta is in a sense the path between the ground and the fruition, as you just said, which are both Buddha nature. I guess that's what it means, you know, in the sense that you have to relate with all these qualities in the path, and therefore they're calling it a receptacle. It seems like entityizing it, but nevertheless.
So curiously, you and I have just discussed bodhicitta in terms of relative bodhicitta. What about ultimate bodhicitta?
Yeah, that's certainly part of it too. but then there we're already at the end point, right? Isn't
Well, we cultivate ultimate bodhicitta along the way. So I think ultimate bodhicitta is non-conceptual wisdom.
Which you would say is different than the end point?
Yes, it's the foundation for the accomplishment of the end point,
Foundation of the accomplishment.
which is what's being presented here, right?
Yeah, I mean, actually, this whole section where it was talking about the foundation, there was something in the very beginning that this is what actually kind of threw me in the very beginning when they said,
Yeah, the
on
foundation
which the foundation of the fundamental change, based on which
occurs.
foundation of the fundamental change this change takes place, which I thought was, you
Such
know,
convoluted language.
totally. And I, because I, it's like I can understand what part of the foundation but changes, but this is saying what foundation of the change changes or something, you know, which is really weird.
Yeah, it's like there's some the first when you just said I can see that there's a foundation that changes, that's like an entity that changes. And then when we say, well, there's a foundation for that change to come about, that's like a quality. Sort
I even
of.
figured out, I mean, I tried to figure this out and couldn't really. And I just figured, okay, I'm going to have to read through it a few more times, but
The English was very convoluted.
yeah.
I thought that that phrase also was very peculiar. Anyway, you may wonder, on the bottom of 259, it is said that based on such focal objects, the characteristics of conceptions about the existence of that on which one focuses are blazing. Therefore, how could this be non-conceptual wisdom? Did anybody wonder this? Are blazing. That's an interesting one. Okay. Instruction on the comprehension of the relinquishment of characteristics. The comprehension of the relinquishment of characteristics through 4 points is to be understood by a virtue of relinquishing the characteristics of antagonistic factors, of remedies, of suchness, and the dharmas of realizations. So, does the relinquishment cover all four factors, or is relinquishing the characteristic of antagonistic factors one, and then by virtue of remedies, suchness, and the dharmas, probably the latter. What is to be taught here are one, the nature of these four characteristics, two, their order, and three, what is eliminated based on what? First, the antagonistic rather factors are the four kinds of clinging to impermanent sentient beings as being permanent, clinging to what is empty and conditioned as being real entities, clinging to samsaric existence, which has the nature of the three sufferings as being really existent. And clinging to identityless phenomena as having an identity. These seem very repetitive. Permanent, real.
Well,
I don't
there's
know.
beings and phenomena. Those are the first and the last. And then in between those is clinging to samsaric existence, the sufferings, as real. So beings, phenomena, existence. And what's the other one?
They're repetitive.
Oh, yeah. What is empty as real? Goodness. Yeah, it does seem like
Yeah.
there's a little redundancy there, but probably they have some reason.
These are characteristics of mistakenness because they cause bondage and samsara. They are not in accordance with correct cognition. The remedies consist of understanding that what is conditioned is impermanent. Understanding that everything imaginary is empty. Understanding that all who wander in samsaric existence are not beyond the three sufferings. And understanding that nirvana is peace because all phenomena lack an identity and what is mine.
So is that last four the four marks?
It is. They're both, yeah, the first is the wrong understanding of the marks, and the second set is the four marks. But the third one is all who wander in existence are not beyond suffering. And so the opposite of that is thinking that there is an existence without suffering, which doesn't come through here, but that's one of the opposites, one of the four wrong views that the
Right.
four
It seems like
marks.
they're saying, here they talk about samsaric existence as being really existent as opposed to being not suffering, which is what you would think they would be.
Right.
I
That's the one that's on.
know.
These are the remedies of samsara. Those characteristics that are remedies cause liberation from non-virtue. Therefore, they are common to all three jhanas. When they say three jhanas here, we're talking Sravakas, Pratyeka Buddhism, Bodhisattva jhanas. As for suchness, the third of the four virtues, both the factors to be relinquished and their remedies are mere cognizance, are mere mind. Everything is mere mind. If one clings to them as characteristics, one will not be liberated from the imaginary and the dependent natures. Interesting reference to the three natures. Since the cognizances, that's a tongue twister, of the factors to be relinquished and their remedies, which are produced through the conceptions of factors to be relinquished and their remedies, are without arising and ceasing. They are unconditioned by nature. If they're produced, how can they be unconditioned? This is the nature of phenomena. That is the perfect nature. So the completely perfected nature is the third of the three natures in the Yogacara tradition. But cognizances which are produced are
But note that it
unconditioned,
says without arising or ceasing, or without arising or ceasing.
which are produced through conceptions of factors to be relinquished and their remedies there without arising and ceasing. They're produced, but they're without arising and ceasing. This is the nature of phenomena that is the perfect nature. Those who see the Buddha heart, Tathagatagarbha, as consisting of the paramitas of supreme purity, self, bliss, and permanence are the children of the victors. So here we have the four opposites of the four marks presented as the true nature of Buddhahood. Buddhahood is supreme purity, supreme self, supreme bliss, and supreme permanence. Lastly, the characteristic of realization refers to training and perfecting the qualities. And by the way, here you have purity, self, bliss, and permanence. So earlier we had a difficulty finding the bliss. Everything else, I think. Anyway, lastly, the characteristic of realization refers to training and perfecting the qualities such as the fourfold mastery, as well as the enlightened activity. As for the order of these four characteristics, Maitreya says, through this, in due order, they are described as coarse, middling, subtle, and what is associated for a long time. The characteristic of the antagonistic factors is coarse because they are the causes of the impregnations of negative tendencies and are easy to understand. The characteristic of their remedies is middling. The characteristic of suchness is subtle because it is the mere focusing on the appearance of non-conceptual wisdom and is the remedy for everything that is other than it. Since the characteristic of realization is the result of familiarization, it is that with which a bodhisattva is associated for a long time because it remains up to the end of the continuum of the 10 bhumis. Thirdly, as for what is eliminated based on what, in the Avikalpa Pravesha Dharani, the afflictions are relinquished and the remedies eliminating the conceptions to be relinquished. Relinquishment of what is to be relinquished, that is, through clinging to samsaric existence as the factor to be relinquished and clinging to suchness as the remedy. Among these four characteristics, since it is necessary to accomplish the fruition that consists of the two kayas, through making them unequal, the two characteristics of factors to be relinquished and remedies are eliminated on the paths of accumulation and preparation. The factors to be relinquished on the path of accumulation and the remedies on preparation, presumably. The characteristic of suchness is relinquished on the 7 impure bhumis. This is the part that's real interesting, is relinquishing the characteristic of suchness, the characteristic of realization, the fruition on the 3 pure bhumis, and the last of all characteristics through the Vajra-like samadhi of the 10th bhumi. These are discussed through the example of a gem that exists beneath the earth. In due order, things like earth, stone, silver, gold, and various precious gems are removed, and then a precious gem, a beryl, comes forth. Oh, that was in the Dharani that we read at the beginning. Remember, like people were mining for different things, and the bodhisattva's mined for the beryl. That was a little convoluted of an example. It was confusing. Anyway, the correct yogic practice. Is this where the reading paused? Where did we start to fit? No. To explain the mind that trains in focusing on the elimination of those characteristics in such a way, Maitreya gives the general instruction. The comprehension of the correct yogic practice through 4 points. What are these four? It's through the yogic practice of observation, through the yogic practice of non-observation, through the yogic practice of the non-observation of observation, through the yogic practice of the observation of non-observation. These guys are such comedians. First, on the path of preparation, the yogic practice of the observation of all dharmas and their meanings as being mere cognizance relinquishes the entirety of the imaginary and makes bodhisattvas see that their own awareness does not exist as the duality of apprehended and apprehender. The trim sheikah. So the trim sheikah is the 30 stanzas. Trim is 30, and sheikah refers to stanzas. It's a text by Vasubandhu. He wrote a 20-stanza one called the Vimshika, or the Vimshatika, and the Trimshika. And the Trimshika presents the three natures. For as long as consciousness does not dwell in mere cognizance, the after effects of twofold grasping will not come to a halt. For as long as consciousness does not dwell in mere cognizance, so as long as you don't rest your mind in mind only, or mere cognizance only, the effects of the twofold grasping to self and other will not come to a halt. Then, on the path of seeing, bodhisattvas cultivate the yogic practice of the non-observation of mind. This mere cognizance, too. So the words, this mere cognizance, is a gloss or explanation of the practice of the non-observation of mind, means is described as being the practice of mere cognizance. Also, or two, because this very cognizance has the nature of the dependent. The cognizance is the Alaya-Vijñāna, which is the dependent nature. For since this cognizance has the nature of the apprehender, if they did not go beyond it, they do not see the perfect nature. So in order to see the perfect nature of reality, we have to go beyond the dependent nature of the sense of apprehender and apprehended. The Trimshika by Vasubandhu continues, but all this is mere cognizance refers to this observing too. The observing is also mere mind. Anything that is propped up before the mind means not dwelling in merely that cognizance. So as long as we're observing something, even if it's the fact that all phenomena are mere cognizance, then we're still dwelling in a dualistic mind. If there are no reference, cognizance is not tenable. Therefore, this is called the yogic practice of non-observation, where we experience the absence of reference. It is what relinquishes both apprehender and apprehended, which is the main thing that's overcome on the path of preparation. The Trimshika says, when consciousness itself does not observe any focal object, it rests in the very being of mere consciousness. This is like shamatha without object, right? Since there is no apprehender without something apprehended. Based on the yogic practice of the non-observation of cognition in this way, what is observed is non-conceptual wisdom. If there's non-observation, then one rests in the observation of non-conceptual wisdom, which is presumably a non-observation. This is the beginning of the fundamental change. Oh, so here we go. We're leading up to a crescendo here. Finally, drum roll. Then it is no mind and non-perception. It is supramundane wisdom, which transcends mind, presumably. This is the fundamental change. By virtue of having relinquished the twofold impregnations of negative tendencies. What are those? Not the negative tendencies, the twofold impregnations. 76. Right. Oh my God. It's a very long footnote. Never mind.
Is it possible you could send us the footnotes at some point?
Yeah, that's a good idea. Let me make a note of that. Let me make a note of that. Okay. Thus, the non-observation of the mind, with the duality of apprehender and apprehended, which is impaired by the afflictions, supramundane wisdom will be observed. Based on this non-conceptual wisdom, the two impregnations of negative tendencies that are to be relinquished through seeing and familiarization, respectively, will be relinquished. Also, the Mahayana Sutra Alankara teaches the above order of this. The mind is aware that nothing other than mind exists. The mind is aware that nothing other than mind exists. Then it is realized that mind does not exist either. The intelligent ones are aware that both do not exist and abide in the Dharma Dhatu in which these are absent. Then this text, the Vimshika, continues. No, the Trimshika, sorry. The power of the non-conceptual wisdom of the intelligent, which is always and everywhere accompanied by equality, clears the dense thicket of the collection of flaws on that foundation, just as a great antidote does with poison. Thus, based on that, the two obscurations are eliminated. In this way, up through the seventh bhumi, bodhisattvas proceed through the training in the equality. Excuse me, of samsaric existence in peace, as it is still based on the characteristic of suchness. Okay, so they haven't relinquished the characteristic of suchness. Immediately upon seeing the eighth bhumi, when conception, mentation, and perception have become pure, that's an interesting triad. Fourth, the training in the observation of non-observation arises. For example, even while knowing one's swimming in a great river in a dream to be a dream, one still makes intense efforts to reach the other shore. However, immediately upon waking up, nothing whatsoever of all this appears, and one is free from any effort. Likewise, while non-conceptual wisdom appears on the first seven bhumis, bodhisattvas still make intense efforts to train in the wisdoms of meditative equipoise and subsequent attainment. Immediately upon attaining Buddhahood, being free from such efforts, there will be no such appearances. Also, immediately upon that, as many Tathagatas as there are grains in this, as their sand grains in the river Ganga show their faces and rouse these bodhisattvas who rest in the dhatu of non-conceptuality. They rouse them by saying, "O children of good families, this dhatu of the lack of appearances in common with Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas. However, without resting in it, look at our inconceivable kayas, wisdoms, realms, dharmas, and enlightened activities." Based on this cause, those bodhisattvas engaging in training and aspiration prayers, dharanis, discriminating awarenesses, pure realms, and the ornament of the heart of enlightenment through giving rise to limitless appearances of wisdom while not conceptualizing anything. Therefore, this is called the training in the observation of non-observation and also the characteristic of the fruition. Such is the synopsis of what the Dasabhumika Sutra, which is the Ten Grounds Sutra, and also the Lankavatara Sutra say. And we'll pause there. Oh, just a little bit more. Let's finish this point. The summary of this is found in an old translation of the Lankavatara Sutra. By relying on mere mind, those of good fortune relinquish it too. By relying on mere mind, they must even go beyond non-appearance. If a yogin rests in non-appearance, he does not see the Mahayana or she. Kamalashila's Madhyamaka Bhavana Krama says the yogin who rests in non-appearance sees the Mahayana. Thus, his reference to just the last part of the newer translation does not consider the detailed explanation preceding it, and thus takes it to be a quote on meditative equipoise being without appearances, which I see as an error. Oh my God.
Is that basically referring to the fact that the Kamala Sheela lines are saying the opposite of the other last two lines?
Yeah, that's right.
And so that's why he's saying that that one of
It's
them
an
is an error.
error. Yeah.
And so is this thing that they're talking about in this last paragraph about rousing the bodhisattvas who rest in the dhatu of non-conceptuality. So this is different than rousing the shravakas and pracheka buddhas, but yet it sounds similar, right?
Exactly. It certainly sounds similar. And since they're talking, they do say bodhisattvas, so it would have to be different from the shravakas, pracheka buddhas.
Right, that was the clue.
But the implication of this is that shravakas and pracheka buddhas achieve a wisdom or a realization equal to the seventh bhumi.
Which you have said in previous charts and teachings, haven't you?
That's correct, yeah.
So that's the point where there is some equality.
Yeah, they're equal in wisdom, but not in merit.
Right. And so is there a difference in merit? Do the Buddhas stop at the Bodhisattvas first to wake them up, or out of...
Who gets woken up first?
But
what an interesting
the fact that they
statement.
Actually need to be woken up, or that they're resting in this dhatu of non-conceptuality is a little puzzling.
Yeah,
it doesn't
this
sound like...
dhatu of the lack of appearance is in common with shravakas. However, without resting in it, look at our inconceivable wisdoms. So they're saying to see the emptiness endowed with all the supreme aspects is basically being pointed out.
Right, but the question is, is this something that the bodhisattvas already know and somehow they just kind of got off track a little bit and got lost in this non-conceptuality?
It's not presented that way. It's presented as this is the progression. First okay,
so this is like, this is actually part of the normal path, not an aberration.
Yeah, yeah.
Huh. Curious.
Yeah, they were training in the non-observation of observation, and now they have to train in the observation of non-observation. Interesting. And so this whole thing about the Lanka Vatara, so there's an old translation of the sutra and a newer one, apparently, which has that difference in the last line. And that stanza you see in Carl's Center of the Sunlit Sky, where he goes through the different stages of the progressive stages of meditation on emptiness. And he gives a number of different text references. He quotes from Nagarjuna's praise to Bodhicitta, Bodhicitta Vivarana, and the Lanka Avatara Sutra, as both presenting these stages of understanding of the nature of reality. But this thing at the top of 264, by relying on mere mind, those of good fortune relinquish it too. But then why would they rely on mere mind again to go beyond non-appearance, non-appearance? It seems like it would be by not relying on mere mind, or something like that. Anyway, let us pause there and conclude with our dedication.
Actually, I was going to say, maybe it is just that they're saying, if you get it right, you relinquish it. I mean, I think it's just reiterating that thing about having to go beyond non-appearance. So it's just kind of a wordy way of saying that. I know it's odd. Anyway, sorry to interrupt.
One way or another, regardless of what you rely on, you have to relinquish mind and non-appearance, both
Yeah,
appearance
I
and
think they're almost just
non-appearance.
sort of emphasizing it by saying it twice, maybe with a slightly different angle.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And then Kamala Shields, Madhyamaka Bhavana Krama. I don't think he has a text that has that name. I think the Rongchen Dorje is talking about the first Bhavana Krama, where he goes through a presentation of the Madhyamaka view, essentially. But interesting. By this merit, may all attain omniscience, may it defeat the enemy wrongdoing from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. By the confidence of the golden sun of the great east, may the lotus garden of the Rigdon's wisdom bloom, may the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled, may all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory. Thank you all. Great to see you. Thanks for joining us tonight. Take care and see you
Thank you.
soon. Recording stop.